This is the Bad Apples, episode 20, season 3. My name is Klaatu, I'm your friendly host. If you're new to the show, this is an OG cast about GNU Linux operating system, techie stuff, geeky stuff. It is released only in OG, so if you're looking for MP3 or AAC version, you will not find it is. We're going to be talking about a couple of different things, a Chrome-like browser made possible, I think in theory, by WebKit and Dbus. I'm not going to do a how-to on that because I have no idea, but I will be mentioning it. Talking about a website and their little Internet Explorer faux pas. Talking about some average Joe computer user case studies done by me. Digicam review, just lots of stuff. Listener feedback, you know, just whatever. So stay tuned. I wanted to talk about was something that is way beyond my understanding, but it's really kind of nifty. And once again, it's from this one dude's blog that I keep getting so fascinated by his blog. His name is Ivan Kucic, C-U-K-I-C. You can see why I don't really know how to say that. But yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating blog. I never fail to be fascinated by it, even though I don't understand it. This is the guy who did the program called Lancelot, which is that sort of new kickoff menu on KDE 4. Really, the best iteration of it so far has been 4.2. That's when it's really come into its own at this point. But there are obviously obviously it's been around since KDE 4.0, so. But yeah, and he's done that, and he just does a lot of Plasma and Qt-related stuff, and it's really pretty neat. And in his March 29th entry on his blog, he was talking about WebKit plus Dbus to provide instant Chrome-like browser for GNU Linux. And I thought, well, that's interesting only because, you know, Chrome is still kind of a topic. I mean, it seems to have waned a lot, but it's something that you know that is still kind of out there. So what he did was he kind of figured out a way to use the standard UI building blocks that is WebKit to make basically a browser that is like Google's Chrome, separated into different processes for different tabs. So if something crashes in one tab, the browser stays open. It's just that one tab that has crashed. And apparently it's not difficult to make that at all. You just create the main window, and I'm assuming you would do this in Qt Creator or Kdevelop. You create the main window, and you start the WebKit, which is QWebView, in another program, and then you X-embed QWebView into the main window. And they can communicate to each other via Dbus, which, of course, I have no idea what that is. It's some underlying technology that KDE always seems to be excited about. And if the child process crashes, you lose one tab. And if the main process crashes, the tabs become independent windows. How about that? So it's fascinating. It's really neat. He says if he finds the time, he'll try to get this into something like Reconk, which is a SourceForge project that was based on, I think, Nokia's Demo Qt browser, which I haven't seen, but I guess there's another browser out there called Aurora, which is similar, but basically just a Qt-based browser. So, I mean, it would be cool to see this kind of functionality integrated into a new browser for the platform. Personally, you know, I love Firefox. I have no complaints about it, but if I could get a Qt-based browser, I would probably start using one. I mean, one that I really loved. While I use Conqueror a little bit, it has not moved Firefox off of my list of installations that I do right away. So that would be neat. And just the idea of having a browser that is that robust where, yeah, like a tab crashes and it's just that tab, or if the parent process crashes, then all the children become their own parents. I mean, that's just really, really cool to me, and we'll see if that ever happens. I'll try to remember to include the link to that story in the show notes. Interesting case study that I've had the opportunity to execute lately has been about the mythical, ever-elusive, average Joe computer user that I'm always trying to understand and kind of grasp what they are and who they are and what they expect and what they need. The reason I'm being so philosophical about it is because I have been using computers my entire life, as probably many of you who have listened to this show have been. So when you think about Linux and you kind of think about what everyone else needs when they sit down in front of a computer, I keep getting this feeling that we as geeks are really, really far removed from reality. And maybe you aren't as far removed from it as I am. Maybe you have a family and you've got a good idea of what, you know, the wife and the kids kind of need when they sit down in front of a computer. So if you're assessing Linux, sort of benchmarking it compared to other OSs, maybe you know exactly where Linux is lacking and where it actually stands firm and solid. I don't have that, and so I'm always trying to understand what those people need, what those Windows users need that they can or can't get from Linux. So just recently, I was visiting friends down in Maryland, and the minute I walked in the door, you know, someone said, oh, Klaatu, he worked for, you know, such and such a computer company. He knows all about computers. He can fix anything. They all break out their laptops or their desktops and turn them on, and there's nothing but Windows. I know nothing about Windows. So, what was I to do? They wanted me to fix their computers. They're all running Windows. No idea. I couldn't even get an a big part of what they wanted me to fix in the end was just the network situation. On Windows, I have no idea how to get what the IP address of that machine is. I didn't know in the system where to look, and I tried getting a DOS. I just, in the end, booted from a USB Live Fedora 10, the little 2-gig USB drive that I carry around in my pocket all the time. And so I booted from that, and was able to successfully diagnose all the network problems, fixed that, and just for fun, on one of my friend's laptop, I just left the USB key in there and never rebooted out of Fedora 10. And I just kind of set it down on the coffee table and kind of forgot about it, and people started wanting to check their email and go to Facebook and MySpace and all those things, and so I just let them. I had Firefox open as a full screen, so there was not any indication of what was behind, you know, Firefox, and no one really ever needed to get out of Firefox. So again, you know, the whole 90% of computer users use Firefox 90% of the time, you know, that's kind of, that holds true. People coming in and out of the house, it was a social event, so it wasn't me and a friend. It was me and a friend and people coming in and out as they visited throughout the day. You know, people would check their email. So a neighbor came by because her internet wasn't working. So she came by to send some pictures or some files to her work so that she wouldn't have to go in, you know, that day. So she sat in front of Firefox, did everything she needed. She'd never even used Firefox. She was an Internet Explorer user and was quite fascinated to learn that there was such a thing as, you know, Firefox. She'd kind of heard of it, but she didn't know anything about it, and she was very encouraged to hear that me and another one of my friends were all about Firefox. So she was quite impressed, but it worked fine. I mean, she had to plug in her USB drive, attach a file. I think I mounted the USB drive for her. I don't think I left that up to her, because obviously in Fedora, or not obviously, but in Fedora, the way that it's set up by default, HAL will detect that you've plugged in a USB drive, but it doesn't mount it automatically. So I believe I mounted it for her myself, but then let her do the rest. And so she went into Firefox. She found the USB drive on her own. I don't remember how she managed to do that, you know, to attach the file. I guess Firefox must have been over in the left panel on the browse file browser. I'm not really, I don't remember exactly, but I was just sitting back, just marveling at the fact that she had no idea she wasn't using any version of Windows, and that she did everything she needed to do without any problems. So, and naturally, as all average Joe computer users do, she left herself signed into her email when she left. I didn't do anything, of course. I logged her out, but just something to note. So many, many people came through that day and were using this system, and just, it was a no-brainer is what it was. It was a no-brainer. It just, people used it, never asked about what they were using or why it looked a little bit different or anything like that. Completely just didn't even notice. This impressed me a lot because I just didn't expect it. I expected someone to say, you know, I want to do such and such and I can't, you need to reboot. One thing I did do was install Flash pretty early on because I knew that people were going to want to go to MySpace and click on one of those embedded YouTube files, you know, and watch a video. So I installed Flash pretty early on. Anyway, it impressed me. They all kind of left. I stayed over at my friend's place for, gosh, it must have been 2 weeks. So from day one, pretty much on, it was just kind of a Fedora 10 progression. And so after that first day, seeing how successful it was, I figured I should see how far I could take this. So I installed all the MP3 codecs and all the, you know, all the typical things that people were going to run into on a Windows system, because I wanted very much to duplicate the expected experience. You know, I didn't want them to run into anything that would clue them in on the fact that they were using Linux. So I installed everything that I figured they might need. Oh yeah, and then progressively over the course of that week, really, I started trying to make it look a little bit less Linuxy. And for that, I luckily the neighbor whose internet was not working, she brought her over her laptop, which was running XP according to her, but in reality it was Vista. So I got to see Vista, I think for the second time, and I just kind of took note of some of the characteristics of Vista. And then I went back to my Linux, to this laptop running the USB live distribution. I went ahead and installed Fedora on a partition. This was a Dell Inspiron E1505 or something like that, and it had a restore partition. So I went ahead and installed Fedora over this restore partition because I knew that this friend of mine would never be able to restore from that hard drive if she ran into any problem, and that she'd be calling me for help if ever anything did happen, and I figured it would be better for her to have Linux on there so that I could screen share whatever I needed to do in order to help her out. This was from experience with this particular person. So I did that. Obviously, by now, it was no longer a secret that it was Linux. I mean, she was aware what was going on. I installed it to the hard drive, and then I started really customizing it. Installed a lot of extra packages, customized the background image to what I felt was a very Windowsy looking background, you know, something with grass and a sky. I put widgets or plasmoids, whatever we're calling them, gadgets, up and down the right-hand side of the screen, like Vista seems to have them. I changed the theme of the window border so that it was not the Oxygen theme, but I believe it's called the laptop theme, so it's just a little bit, it would be different from Windows still, but at least, it looks more traditional to me. What else did I do? I installed a theme on Firefox. I think it was called the Arrow theme or something like that to make it look a little bit more like, you know, Vista. And I think it even had a Windows logo on there at some point, which I didn't realize when I was installing the theme. I probably wouldn't have installed the theme if I'd seen that. But it really looked, but by the time it was done, to me, someone who's never used Windows, it really looked like Windows to me. What it looked like to anyone else, I have no idea. Although I do have screenshots of it on unixporn.com. So if you go to unixporn.com, which is not porn, but it is Unix, and just look under my profile, Klaatu, you'll see pictures of the desktop that I was, when I was finished with it. I changed the desktop to be a desktop view rather than the Plasma view, or the folder view, whatever they call it. So it had a home folder and a trash, and I put the Firefox web browser on there, and I also put the email program icon on the desktop as well. So, I mean, everything was there. Everything was running really, really well on this Dell. It was, again, a Centrino system, and as I said before, I think that the Centrino systems are really good for Linux because it's all in Intel guts. Everything just kind of works. Everything was an Intel Pro wireless card picked up by Linux automatically. The graphics, the resolution was perfect. Everything worked out really, really well. And in the end, it looked, you know, I thought that the system looked really good. I even mounted my friend's Windows partition within Dolphin at one point so that she could browse through her pictures and things like that. So she had a really, really good working system here, and it was all Linux-based, and really she just had no earthly idea of what exactly was going on. She knew it looked different, but she didn't know, you know, she didn't have an understanding of why it was different. She just knew it looked a little bit different, but that everything worked the same as it did. I guess what she noticed is that nothing didn't work, if I can use a double negative. And this goes for a number of people, like I say. Throughout the 2 weeks, people came over. This laptop was sitting on the coffee table, so it was kind of like, oh, this must be the public computer. So everyone was using it. No one noticed a difference at all at any point. Very interesting little study. Is she using Linux now? Probably not. She's probably rebooted by now into Windows and is using that because obviously her files are really there, and I didn't do a full migration or anything like that. But for the 2 weeks that people were kind of using the computer lightly as a public computer, it worked out really, really well. And there were absolutely no problems, no issues. Now, they weren't installing software. They weren't trying to do LimeWire or anything like that. They were just doing typical internet and email kind of usage. But, and some digital photography stuff. But it all worked out really well, and none were the wiser for it. So that's kind of an interesting, I don't know, benchmark or whatever. It certainly helps me understand the average Joe computer user. Maybe it tells you something as well. Now that I've just talked about average Joe computer users, I kind of want to talk a little bit about DigiCam, the application, but also a little bit about dealing with other computer users looking over your shoulder, as it were. So let's start maybe with other users looking over your shoulder, as it were. So being around other people, kind of not, you know, being around non-geeks for the first time in a very, very long time, I was hypersensitive to what they were thinking about the computers that I brought with me. I had my triple E PC and I had my MacBook, which single boots into Fedora 10, and the Apple logo is covered up by a Linux basement sticker. So there's no outward indication of the brand, although I suspect a lot of people probably recognized it as a Mac because Macs do tend to look a little bit, specific, obvious. And my triple EPC has a penguin sticker on the back. So I was just kind of hyper aware as to what people were thinking about what I was doing. And I came to start to realize that when you are around people, there is, I hesitate to say an obligation, but maybe it's just a desire. You know, when you're running Linux and you're around these other people who aren't geeks and aren't thinking about, wow, how cool it is that your Linux distribution, your Linux computer can play this kind of video without any problems. You know, they're not thinking about that. They expect it to play the video without any problems. They expect it to play this specific audio file without any issues. There's no impressing these people with things that Linux can do because they don't have any understanding of how hard it was for some Linux programmer to actually figure all that stuff out. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us with making sure that your Linux computer is up to par with everyone else's computer, that it can do the stuff that people are going to expect to do on their own computer, so that when they come over to you and say, oh, can I do such and such, that you're able to accommodate that desire so that they don't have to pull out their Windows computer and boot it up. You see what I'm saying? So if they come over to you and they sit down and they say, oh, I want to look at this YouTube video, and you say, well, you know, YouTube uses Flash, and I hate Flash because it's proprietary software, they're not going to understand what you're talking about. They're just going to hear, my computer doesn't do that, boot up Windows. Over the course of these 2 weeks, I started to kind of fine-tune some of my, at least on my MacBook, I started to kind of, I should not say MacBook, my Apple-branded Fedora book, I started to kind of fine-tune what applications I was actually using. For instance, there are a lot of digital photos happening here. So when people would come over with an SD card or a computer with a USB cable, as the case may be from my computer, since Apple-branded computers at this point in time do not have an SD card slot, but that's another story for another day, I'm sure. You know, they plug it in, they want to look at their digital photos, or they want to give you the digital photos, but they also want to look at it with you on the computer. Just breaking out Dolphin and clicking on the folder, on the photo, and waiting for it to open up in Gwyn view, or even in Conqueror and letting it open up in Conqueror, it just doesn't seem, it doesn't feel the same to them as a nice photo managing application. And so I started using DigiCam a lot more than I ever had before. Well, in fact, I started using DigiCam at all. I kind of avoided it before, which will segue into my review of DigiCam. But let this segment be about, I guess, representing Linux in a way that the average computer user can identify it as a reasonable operating system. And walking into the place with my really hacked together triple EPC, I mean, it's got Debian with KDE 4 point something from the testing repos or the unstable repos, no media player installed other than MPlayer, things like that, where, to me, I mean, it's great. It runs, it does exactly what I need it to do. But for people seeing that and trying to impress them with that kind of user experience, they just don't want to hear about it. They don't want to see it. They would much rather boot into Windows because it's just easier for them. It's more familiar. It's the way they're used to doing things. Switching on Linux and opening up applications that frankly rival the proprietary competition, now that impresses them. Sure, it might be done differently. They might not know how to do something, but I think people can deal with that. At least they can identify the interface as something that they could eventually learn. So those are my observations on that. Now let me segue smoothly into DigiCam review.
Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
Okay, so I'm the last person on the planet Earth that would ever say that I like a photo management application. My previous experience with photo management had been mainly things like Aperture, which was by Apple, and Lightroom by Adobe. There was also Bridge way back before Lightroom or Aperture existed. And there was, of course, iPhoto, which you just couldn't avoid if you were around Mac users, because that was just kind of, that was the everyday Mac user photo application. I hated iPhoto second only to iTunes. It was a horrible way of managing photos. Aperture wasn't much better. It had many of the same paradigms of how it's going to manage your data for you. Lightroom was a lot better, really. I mean, it never really fit my workflow. No photo management application ever really fit my workflow. But Lightroom, of all of them, kind of worked the best because you had a lot more control over how you viewed your photos and where you kept your data on your hard drive, things like that. Bridge, same thing. I mean, Bridge wasn't really it was just more like an interface, a file browsing interface, so that doesn't really compare. But either way, I never really loved the idea of photo management applications. Never had a good experience with them. Never really got into that way of working. And so I kind of ignored them for a very long time. And my photo manager was Dolphin or Conqueror. It's just my file manager. That worked for me, and it worked quite well. And I saw no reason to change that. Until, like I say, other users started to kind of expect me to have a photo management application on my computer. Then I started looking at it. But I would never think that I would actually be impressed by one, or really have a desire to use one. But, you know, lately, I have been really, really impressed with DigiCam. And the only reason I chose DigiCam over, you know, anything else, was because DigiCam is often in my RSS feed catcher, feed reader, whatever, because I'm on a lot of KDE feeds, so DigiCam has been kind of active lately. They've been porting everything over to Qt 4, so they've been having a lot of releases lately. So they were kind of on my mind somehow when I was, I think it might have even been installed on my Fedora system already. So when I plugged in a camera, it might have just offered to open it up in DigiCam. But yeah, I started using it because people wanted to view photos in a proper photo managing environment. And the reasons that it has impressed me have been, there is the huge issue of it being a really nice looking application. Not that that's important per se, although, as we all know, it really is. I mean, if you've got an application and it looks like it's 10 years old, the impression that it makes on you as well as other people, it really kind of, it starts to go down pretty quickly. You know it's an old application, you know something's up with it, you don't want to use it, whatever. But DigiCam looks and feels great. It's got themes, which are not just pretty themes. They're functional themes. You know, you've got your dark theme, you've got your light theme, you've got everything in between. It's a really nice, customizable kind of interface. There is the typical, or now it's typical, Qt 4 flexibility of your interface, where you can just pick up toolbars and move them around, things like that. There's also the sense that it's very, very, very integrated into the rest of your system if you are running KDE. At first, when I was starting with KDE, there were certain little things that the KDE, the K apps seemed to do that I couldn't really get used to right away. For instance, in Amarok and DigiCam, you've got that sidebar of icons down the left and sometimes the right of the window. And while you see the icons, but you don't have a feel for them being tabs for your interface. But after a while, you get used to it. You know, these are K-apps. You start seeing the same kind of traditions or the same kind of models being used. You know, okay, you've got these tabs down the left-hand side, and if I click on that, that changes the rest of my window, or it slides out a little interface drawer or whatever. So you kind of get the feel for what these do. And then once you start using more and more K apps, obviously you start to get used to this mode of working, this model of working. So there's the integration, so to speak, of just being like all the other K apps, which is not insignificant. It is significant. I'm using a lot of double negatives today. But I mean, that's the idea of integration. And I've talked about this before in my thoughts on an OS and on integration within that environment and being user-friendly and things like that. And so even though all of these applications are being independently written by different programmers, you look at them side by side and they actually look really, they look integrated, they look user-friendly, because now if you've used Amarok, suddenly if you go over to DigiCam, you're not really lost anymore. It becomes a lot more intuitive because you know where to look for certain functions, or you know what little icons might suggest, what they might mean. And that's really very important, I think, for interface design. So that's a good thing. The other thing about DigiCam, one of the many things about DigiCam, is that I remain in control of all the data. There are no hidden database folders. It doesn't take all your photos and hide them away in some kind of database that you can't access directly, that you have to suddenly go through this application in order to access. It's simply, intelligently, smartly, ridiculously simply, it looks at your folders in whatever folder you deem as your main data folder for your pictures. It looks at that and it says, okay, well, here's all of the pictures that you have on your drive. You can organize them into DigiCam albums, but it doesn't rearrange any of your data. It's just within DigiCam. So, and if you choose to move it on the back end, you know, in your file manager, then next time you boot up DigiCam, it rescans all of that stuff and makes sure that DigiCam is up to date with what you've done on the back end. So that's a huge deal, and you might not think it's a huge deal, but if you've ever dealt with Aperture or iPhoto, which hopefully you never have, that's actually a big deal. I believe Lightroom does the same thing as DigiCam. Lightroom, and that's, I believe, if memory serves, or unless they've changed something, that was one reason why I actually tolerated Lightroom back when I used Adobe products, because they didn't try to take control of your data. Another thought on themes, actually, you know, like I say, DigiCam has quite a few different themes. One thing that you'll notice about proprietary applications is that they don't actually want you to be able to theme the application too much, because they figure there's a brand identity in the way that the application looks, right? If you've got some proprietary application and you're able to change it drastically, they're afraid that someone walking by the computer isn't going to recognize that. Whereas if there's a certain look for that application and a certain way things are done, then people strolling by or using it, they'll be able to remember, yes, this is that application. I should spend my money on that application. Digicam and other free software projects don't really have that incentive to force you to do things their way. So you've got a lot of themes in Digicam so that you can change things so that they suit your workflow and the way you like to edit things or do things. So that's quite nice. And I think something that doesn't just apply to Digicam, it's something about free software that is really quite nice. There's no conflict of interest over it's our brand versus you saying, yeah, but it's the way I want to look at it or it's the way I want to work. Yeah, I mentioned that it was intuitive. There's also, I mean, Digicam itself has a lot of editing capabilities within the application. So if I choose a photograph and I realize I need to, well, one example is that I had a photograph that someone had taken, and it was crooked. It was about, let's call it 20 degrees clockwise crooked. It needed to be taken negative 20 degrees, or 20 degrees, I should say, counterclockwise. And we were looking at the thing in Digicam, and they mentioned that, yeah, they'd taken the picture a little bit skewed, and that would have to be corrected at some point. So I just went straight over to the image menu in Digicam, down to Edit. Or if I'd known the keyboard shortcut, I could have used F4. And it opened up the photograph in its own little editing environment. And you can do whatever you need to do. You can transform it free rotation. You can do a perspective adjustment, resize, crop, flip it left, flip it right. You know, whatever you need to do, it's done right there. And then you can save it as a copy. The impression this made on the person looking at the photograph was profound. They were amazed that I was able to be looking at the digital photo and then just right away rotate the thing and save it, and there, it's fixed. They don't have to take it into Photoshop or whatever they were going to go off and use. It was just done just like that. I'm sure that any good photo management application is able to do that. It's not a big deal, but again, I think the key here is not to impress people, but not to not impress people. You know, they should see things being done that makes their life easier, and something that they do not then have to go boot into Windows to do. There's also, I think, a really cool feature in Digicam called the Light Table, which I do know the shortcut for that because I actually used it quite a bit. You just hit L, and that'll open up the Light Table, and you can just drag and drop photos into the Light Table, and if they're two very similar photos, for instance, you'll be able to zoom in on, you know, a certain corner or maybe a person's face so that you can see their expression closer or whatever, and you can compare two or three or four photos this way. Because you know how digital camera photography is. You take five different pictures of essentially the same thing in hopes of getting the best shot. Take it into the Light Table, examine it, choose your best one. You can delete, or you can give it 5 stars and give the others 1 star, whatever you want to do to set that one apart so that you know that, yeah, that was the take. That's the printable picture. So basically, it's all about the features that should be there, that the usual features of a photo management application. They're in Digicam, and that's the important thing. There's, you know, you can edit the metadata. You can do a crop according to an aspect ratio so that you don't crop something at some weird 4.25 by 6.05. You know, it'll do it for you, 4 by 6. So it's a typical photographical kind of aspect ratio for printing. You can filter your view. You can give ratings for the photos. You can do a slideshow. You can even have OpenGL transitions if you want. So you can do all these things that, yeah, I mean, they're not a big deal. They're not innovative or anything like that, but they're there. They're there because they need to be there. Now, certain things are fairly innovative, I think, like the geolocation feature. I know that this is implemented in a couple of other programs, but I don't know I feel like, at least as far as I could tell, DigiCam was either on the cutting edge or right on the same edge as the other programs that are actually utilizing this function. But you've got the geolocation, and you've got this, you can bring up a globe view, and you'll see the Earth, and you can click on it and drag it around, and then you can filter things by the location that they are actually taken, the photographs, the actual physical location that they were taken in. That impressed people a lot. Actually, I didn't bother geotagging anything, and no one apparently had cameras that geotagged automatically, but the idea of it impressed people, and the fact that you could click and spin the turn the globe around impressed people. So, whatever it takes, right? The exporting feature was a huge hit, ridiculous hit. In DigiCam, it's got an export menu with nothing less than, I think, 8 export options available to you, if not more. I mean, I think there are probably plugins that I could have installed to get even more, but there was export to Flickr, export to SmugMug, export to Facebook, export to Picasa, just HTML gallery, export to gallery, all kinds of different exporting options, and people loved this because Facebook is always changing their interface. No one knows how to, from one week to the next, no one can figure out how to upload photos the way that they want to. Flickr the same way. People don't want to sign into their Flickr account to upload a photo. And when I showed them that I was able to simply, of course I was discovering this for the first time myself as well, but simply click on the photo that they liked and then upload it to their Flickr account, it was a huge hit. That's a huge, big deal. Competitor iPhoto just got, like a couple of months ago, the ability to upload straight to, I think they're doing Flickr, I think that's the one thing that they're conceding actually exists outside of their own little Apple world, and that's about it. Maybe there are others, I haven't kept up with it lately, but these are new features for iPhoto, and even then it's still not as robust as the features here. Overall, DigiCam definitely impressed. Not just because, yeah, it's on par with all the other applications out there, but because it's a really, really fine example of free software. If you use it, I think that you will be impressed. I mean, if you're into photo management applications, and possibly if you're not, because like I've said, I'm not that into them myself usually, but the stability and the robustness of this application really, really impressed me. It felt like one of those applications that was actually done right. You know, it didn't feel like they had played around with programming one day and got an application to where it would kind of boot and more or less work and then walked away from it. It was more like, yes, this is the application as we intended it, and it works well, it works reliably, it's got cool features that you might not be able to find in a lot of the other typical applications of its type. It's integrated with the rest of the desktop. If you're starting to learn, you know, it's intuitive. If you're starting from the basis of this environment, it fits within that environment to the point of being intuitive as you start to kind of learn the environment. So this is good stuff. DigiCam is definitely something that is just really well done. I was very impressed, and I would highly recommend it to anyone who's running KDE or a lot of K apps. It's just a really solid program. It just came out with their 0.10 release, which doesn't seem like that big of a number, but I know that it's a major release for them, and justly so. It's a really good application. I think it's a fine example of free software, really. So give it a shot. That's almost all I have for this episode, I think. One small announcement I should make is that Monster B from Linux Cranks podcast, or Augcast as the case may be, is going to do some kind of episode, maybe for Hacker Public Radio, about how people found out about Linux, which is an interesting question, I think, for a lot of us geeks who are running Linux now. It's a matter of curiosity about, yeah, how did you find Linux? How did you start running Linux? Why did you start? Whatever. Not asking for a life story or anything, but maybe just a brief comment, brief note on how you encountered Linux and maybe why you started running it. Now, this is interesting, I think, just because, you know, it helps everyone to get to know each other better, but also because it kind of helps us, I guess, as a community, understand how the community got built in a way. I mean, I know it's an internet phenomenon, and Linux got built largely because the internet existed and people could talk, you know, worldwide, and people came together to work on something, stuff like that. But I mean, just how are people finding out about the OS, and how are people starting to use it? If you think about what big companies do, and even certain free software organizations do, you know, I mean, like Debian has a popularity contest, things like that, or maybe that's Fedora, but, you know, different groups have different, no, I think it's Debian popularity contest. Fedora has Smolt. But, you know, they kind of do quote-unquote marketing research. And it's not necessarily for marketing, but it is for marketing. It's where are these people coming from? How are they finding out about Linux? Are people listening to podcasts? Or are they buying magazines? Or are they buying books? Or are they finding this stuff via the internet? How are we all finding this OS that we use? And, how are we starting to use it as maybe our exclusive OS, whatever. So if you want to do a quick segment, doesn't have to be anything fancy, just do a quick segment on how you found Linux and send that to monsterb@linuxcranks.info, or you can post it on your server somewhere, or a server somewhere, Dropbox, whatever, and then send an email with a link to monsterb@linuxcranks.info. Or if you want to email me, it's klaatu@linuxcranks.info or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. Just let us know that you've recorded something and that it's ready to be integrated into whatever kind of compilation he comes up with. That would be, I think, really cool. So do that. Let's do some listener feedback and then wrap this episode up. So I got an email from Travis Bigrig, who was asking me about monitor calibration under Linux and whether I'd had any experience with Spider 2, which is a little hardware device that you basically put in front of your monitor and you kind of get the readings, the color temperature readings from that, and then you can compare, you know, you can save that profile, or you can use it on another monitor to calibrate the two monitors to make sure that you're getting basically the same look out of each monitor. I have had no experience with that under Linux at all. So, unfortunately, I emailed him back just with what experience I did have, but I have not been doing really that much that requires monitor calibration under Linux. I haven't done any graphics for print in a very long time, certainly since I've come to Linux, so I haven't really done that. And then the video related stuff, I don't like to calibrate monitors for that, because the way that I work, I'll do my real work on one monitor at all times under very, very similar lighting conditions. I figure any other monitor that I'm going to view this on is actually representative of the way that the audience is going to see it. You know, no one's going to have the same, no one's going to calibrate their monitor or their TV set or their screen to what I color corrected it on or whatever. What's the point? I actually prefer not to have it calibrated so that I can see it on a variety of different platforms or a variety of different monitors. That is the answer to that, the long and short of it. However, if you do have experience with this, I would love to hear from you if you want to email me, and I will certainly pass on any helpful information to Travis, because it's important, you know. I mean, color calibration is important, especially for print, or not even for print. I mean, if you have a workflow where you do have a lot of different computers that you're going to be working on something on, you want to calibrate those monitors. So let me know if you've got any experience with that, for sure. Deep Geek who you might know from Hacker Public Radio, has started his own podcast. So if you want to check that out, you probably should. And the way that you can check that out is it's called talkgeektome.us. Hop on over to talkgeektome.us. And this is actually, so far, a really cool podcast. I have heard one episode, which is the episode that he has published. So he's got one episode out so far. His first episode's really cool. It's about like web servers and stuff like that. A lot of information in there that I had no idea about, so I found it quite helpful. Gibby Gibb, he listens to my show and says that he's using KDE 4.2, I think 4.2.1 specifically, with I think Kubuntu, and said that, he says, quote, "I'd always seen that KDE 4 was on its way to better things, but like I said earlier, it was just too unstable for me to enjoy before. But yeah, now he's saying that he likes it a lot. He's finding, you know, just the little auto notifications when you plug in the USB drive, or the way that you extract a file, you know, with Arc, you can just extract it to whatever folder you want, just little things like that. He's finding it quite nice to use. He's very impressed. So was I. Acid Flux. He emailed me and also said, yeah, 4.2 is really cool. And he says, just wanted to drop you a line and thank you for your recent evangelizing of 4.2, KDE 4.2. I've always loved Conqueror with its multiple plugins. I've missed using KDE since it hasn't worked on my laptop, but the current... the previous one showed artifacts on the screen, just annoyed me to no end. Current one is absolutely wonderful. My laptop can't run Vista Aero, but it has even better right now with 4.2.1. It's beautiful to look at and use. It makes my computer more fun to use. I can't thank you enough. Yeah, me too, Acid Flux. I absolutely agree with everything that you've said. I think KDE looks great. It feels great. It works great. Just can't say enough positive things about it. He also says, I heard your HPR on Krita and agree that it is a nice program, although I find it hard to use only because I've spent so much time using the GIMP. Yeah, that's exactly my issue. Krita, like a lot of the other K apps, it's a really nice app. I like that it's Qt-based, so it's really integrated with the rest of my you know, user environment, but it's not something that you can jump right into if you're already kind of settled into the GIMP, because now you've adjusted yourself for GIMP, which you've probably already transferred all your knowledge from Photoshop, so now you're looking at Krita, and now you're looking at learning yet a new way of doing things. So yeah, there's something to be said for that transition. But if you haven't heard my episode on Krita and GIMP on Hacker Public Radio, check it out. It's a good episode, I think. It's not super technical or anything. It's just kind of a rundown of the features of Krita and how they compare in some ways to GIMP. It's something to listen to, and it might give you a good idea of what to expect with Krita if you want to try it. I was impressed with Krita, and just the long and short of it, I think one of the biggest sellers of it would be it looks a lot more like Photoshop than the GIMP does. You know, it's got a lot of the same layout elements. So just for that alone, it might be something to look at. Let's see. Finally, I got an email from Pedro, and he says that he was submitting my Bad Apples feed to SpokenWord.org, which I'd not heard of before. But SpokenWord.org is apparently a site, kind of just an aggregator of lots of different podcasts. So you can go there and check it out. I mean, it's just kind of a handy way of, I think, searching through a whole bunch of different podcasts and kind of filtering it down to things that you're interested in. You know, I mean, I'm sure other, like, Podcast Alley probably does the same thing. But he was submitting me to Spoken Word, which is fantastic. I really appreciate it. And turns out that some dates in my RSS feed were not valid, so it wouldn't accept the feed. That seemed like a drastic thing to me. I mean, because I got, like, the day of the week wrong, according to what the calendar said that date should be. It just wouldn't accept my whole feed. But I went in, corrected them, and now I am in, I guess, SpokenWord.org. So if you haven't been to SpokenWord.org, you can check it out. If you're Pedro and you're listening, thank you for submitting the show to that. Also, if you have a show of your own and you're not on SpokenWord.org, you may want to check that out and submit yourself if one of your kind listeners doesn't do it for you. So, yeah, I think that's about all the listener feedback I've got, except one thing. I've got my first listener audio comment, so I'm going to play that right now.
Hi, Klaatu. This is Matt in Virginia, listener number 13 or so. I thought I would send you a voice message as a little change of pace. You probably get a lot of emails, but you probably don't get many voice messages. Anyway, the point of this is that I found a new respect for your position of being an AUG-only show and for your AUG advocacy. Recently, I discovered a show. Now, this show is about free software and the law and licensing and things like that. But what I find really interesting about this show is that they release an MP3 as well as AUG. Now, that's interesting to me because of all the people who should be advocating AUG only, who better than the Software Freedom Law Show? And we're not talking about a show geared at everybody or at the beginner, like, you know, Free Linux Helpline or Chess's show, Linux Reality. This is a show exclusively for people who have an interest in free software already. And this reminds me of something else that I saw recently, or I listened to recently, a different podcast. They had on a guest who was going to be presenting at Scale. And you probably don't know what that is. You'd never hear about Scale. They keep a really low profile. But anyway, this guy was giving his little spiel, and one of the hosts of the show stopped and, you know, asked him, so, you know, what's your favorite Linux distribution? You know, it's a standard question they ask. And the guy says, well, you know, his co-located server runs Ubuntu, but at his house, they're all Mac OS X. And I was really kind of annoyed at this, because I see it more and more. You know, people that they want to be a part of free software and they want to talk the talk, but they don't want to walk the walk, so to speak. You know, it's really easy to say, oh yes, I love AUG and I think it's a great format and you should use it too. But now let me send you this file in MP3 format. You know what? I think it's time for people that say, you know, they're about freedom, they're about the free formats, and they use AUG, and they like AUG, to actually do it. But again, I think if you're going to do a show about Linux that's geared at a guy who probably has never installed Linux, or would not know the difference between Grub and Lilo, or what Fedora is, or, you know, what's the difference between Ubuntu or Kubuntu, okay, for that show, you can have an MP3 feed. But I mean, if you're doing a show that is geared at the Linux users, people that are fans of Linux, I got to agree with your position. You know, it's time to stand up for what you claim to believe.
That was, yes, the first audio comment I've ever received. Not that I've ever solicited audio comments, not that I'm soliciting them now, but Matt decided to take it upon himself to send in an audio comment, and I appreciated it, and I found it very witty. I also found it slanderous and very offensive, and somewhere out there, a podcaster is crying about not being AUG only. But, you know, that was their choice. I mean, if they want to be MP3 and AUG, that's their choice, and I can understand it, because let's face it, a lot of people's media players do not play AUG, and so it would require conversion and stuff like that. And if your purpose, if your overriding purpose is to deliver content to people quickly and easily, then giving it to them in the format that is most compatible with what you could presume their media player is, i.e. an iPod, then that's what you're going to do. You're going to release it in MP3. Now, I, like Matt, I'm not sure if I agree with that philosophy, because deep down in my heart, I just don't see that if we say, I don't see it that if we say that MP3 is not a valid format, then we are saying that MP3 is a valid format. It's okay to use MP3, and you know, OGG is again just relegated as kind of a backup when convenient codec, and I do not agree with that. I don't agree with the MP3 philosophy. I don't agree with the idea that it's owned by someone outside of our control and et cetera, et cetera. So I agree with you, Matt, and thanks for the audio comment, and it's much appreciated. And I think that really is the end of the show now. So let's do some ending music now. Episode 20 of Season 3 of The Bad Apple. That officially ends this season because, as I said before, my original commitment when I first started this show was to do 20 episodes, and this is the third iteration of that commitment, so next episode will be on Season 4. And I don't take a hiatus or anything like that, I'll just release Episode 1 of Season 4 whenever I get around to recording it. So, welcome to Season 4. And thank you for listening, and I will catch you later. If you need to see me on, or talk to me on IRC, I'm usually in Freenode in the channel Linux Cranks. I am also available via email, klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org, or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. Thanks for listening. Bye.